For me, fashion is a verb. So it's to fashion.
You're listening to Wardrobe Crisis with Claire Press. Join me every week as we look at sustainability, ethics, and the business and madness of fashion. What do your clothes say about you? It's not a trick question. I'm sure if you listen to this show, you've thought about this before. How our clothes talk, how fashion is a language in itself, if you like. But what about the language we use to describe, and by extension to include or to exclude, the people who wear fashion, or maybe don't get to wear it? The people we're marketing to or employing, the people in our communities, or the people we decide we don't want to let in. Fashion communication is not just about clothes. It's about how we talk to each other. Okay, I was in Berlin recently during the city's Fashion Week. Actually, it was quite a while ago. It feels like yesterday. It was February. But I got to take part in this brilliant sustainability conference where the theme was culture and communication. And my guest this week worked on it. Actually, they work for the organisers. They're called Studio MM04. And I'll give it a shout out because it was founded by my mates, Max Gilgerman and Magdalena Schifrin, who, by the way, are massive pioneers in ethical fashion. And we will get them on the show at some point. Anyway, Lou Croft-Blake works for them, as well as being a fashion academic and a queer theorist with a particular interest in diversity, inclusion, equity and belonging, DIEB. And we'll talk about the addition of those extra two words. So not just diversity and inclusion, equity and belonging. So Lou was wearing these mad trousers at the conference. And that's why I wanted them on the show. But I mean, you'll hear us talk about it. You couldn't not invite the wearer of these trousers onto the podcast. So Lou made them as part of what they call their Gender Anarchy Project. Have a look at the show notes for pictures. But these pants are basically covered in writing, in scribbles, in a thesis in cloth. They say things like, all I see is me, and embodiment, empowerment, and then long references to theories. There's like some lovely words actually from the botanist Robin Wall Kimmerer and her idea of restorying. Oh, it's very nice that. I don't know if you've come across her work. We'll share a link in the show notes. So these trousers, says Lou, were created, and I quote, in the midst of a violent and imploding moment in history, radical queer visibility and legacy building. How could I not invite Lou on the show after that? Come on. I thought this was going to be a podcast about vocab. How the words that we choose to use matter so much when it comes to identity and belonging. And respect, actually. Words can be the difference between that and the opposite. Exclusion. Disrespect. The so-called culture wars and this whole false idea of woke versus non-woke narratives. Oh my God, this drives me mad, this stuff. Woke, of course, said with a sneer, where for non-binary and trans people, somehow their lived experience gets discounted and used for political ends. It really is just horrible stuff, this. But Lou says, I feel so lucky to be born in a time when there is vocabulary for in-between, to be outside of the male/female, man/woman binary. So I wanted to ask him about pronouns. Of course I did. That's a good kind of starting point, how the language keeps changing, why it does, how to keep up and navigate all that. And we do address this stuff. But this conversation turned out to be so much more. Yes, words matter. But what matters most is intention. And the existential question, do we really want to build a more ethical fashion industry? And if we do, doesn't that have to be one where everyone can feel a real sense of belonging? Okay, let's sit down with Lou Croft-Blake. Welcome to the Wardrobe Crisis podcast, Lou Croft-Blake.
Thanks, Claire. It's a joy and a little bit of a trip to be here.
Thank you for making the space sort of impromptu, because you've been really busy. It's during Berlin Fashion Week. We met at this brilliant conference that you were part of organizing.
2020-30, long dash, the Berlin Fashion Summit. We can call it 2020-30 Summit for short. It references the decade of change that the UN set for reaching climate goals, which we are not doing as well on as we should be. So between 2020 and between 2030 is when we're supposed to solve all of our problems. We're halfway there.
Okay. This was a pop-up that happened during Berlin Fashion Week, and the theme was culture and communication. You moderated some panels. We're going to come on to that. Oh, but you were wearing the trousers that actually made me want to invite you on the podcast. Let's start there.
We can start with the trousers.
Please do. Yeah. Describe and tell.
So I made these trousers to develop this project, which is all centered around the communicative power of garments and taking it obnoxiously literally. And just, I'm like, what are the loudest pants that I could possibly make? And so they are just covered in text. And the pants are on cotton muslin, which is kind of like the dressmaker's equivalent of sketch paper, you know, just like the most like cheap, bare minimum material you could have. And they tell the story of the pants. The text on the pants talks about what the pants feel like to wear. It talks about the theory that informs why storytelling on garments is interesting to me. I'm like, is this gratuitously navel-gazy? It is.
But yeah, you may say this, but it was the pants that made me go, okay, I think Lou is the person that I want to invite on the podcast this week. And you call yourself formally a fashion practitioner, an artist. You are also a community organizer, but let's just unpack that word fashion practitioner, because before we were recording, I was like, what if it? You've made clear to me that the industry is a place that makes you feel uncomfortable, overproduction, hyper-commercialization, etc. Mm-hmm. And then you said, no, I'm more of a fashion practitioner. And I have to say it tripped me up a bit because I was like, well, what is that?
Well, okay. It's this little line that's at the beginning of your podcast, actually, Claire. This to me, fashion is a verb. And so to practice fashion is to verb the noun. It's not about fashion, the product. It's about fashion, the act of putting stuff onto your body every day, why you make the choices that you make, how it makes you feel in your own skin, this like this very somatic element to it, I think is super important to me, at least. And then also like practicing the communication that happens non-verbally when you're in a community, when you're in a culture. The word we use for it is semiotics, this codified level that dress kind of carries. All of this falls under the umbrella of fashion practice, as well as making the clothes.
It's quite academic, and obviously some of the terms that you've just used are very familiar if you're in fashion academia or if you're, I don't know, someone bookish who likes to look into the theory and meaning behind stuff. But it can also feel, I think, quite exclusive, this terminology. Talk a bit about that, because obviously I love this side of it, but do you think it sort of puts people off? Like even that word practice sometimes from the artist's perspective makes me feel like, oh, you're putting yourself on some sort of pedestal a bit. It's my practice.
Yeah, but I think that spaces where we can democratize this vocabulary a little bit are deeply important because there is power in being able to name something as well. Mm. But I like having words to call a little bit more attention and intention into this because it makes us a little bit more critical of why we put on our bodies what we do. I think that it can make us a little bit more intentional about what we purchase from a sustainability perspective. That is kind of ground zero, right? Actually paying attention to why and how we shop. But also it's fun. It's fun to talk about the practice. I think so many people coast through their lives not even giving it really much thought, but there's so much to be learned about yourself.
And actually, I mean, I was pushing you there to unpack it because I think, obviously, I love this. I love to try to understand what makes the system operate and how we exist within it and in relation to each other. And clothes have got enormous power when we look at fashion that way. And yet we still have this, there is still this broader idea that fashion's just frivolous, it doesn't mean much. And also that it's all about commercial industry perspectives. It's all about what you're going to sell. And I guess what I was thinking there is, if you're listening to this and you want to work as a fashion practitioner and you're intrigued by this idea of critical thinking around how fashion works, how do you get paid?
Oh my God.
I mean, you trained as a designer. Presumably you thought you were going to make some stuff and flog it.
I did, but it's, to be honest, I think when I went to fashion school, I didn't really have that part of it in mind. And then, Yeah, you're right. I was trained as a designer, but I think I kind of did it for all the wrong reasons if I was really trying to make a career out of it. And then immediately after kind of like hardcore fashion school, I went into this sustainability master's program, which is how I got to Berlin, actually, was for this program at Academy of Mode and Design.
Aren't you also a bit of a DJ? Everyone in Berlin's a DJ.
I am a bit of a DJ. It's not why I moved here, but yeah. If you need a DJ for your hot Berlin party, call me.
Okay. But you say your work integrates queer theory with queer community building with the aim of fostering intersectional equity and radical visibility of marginalized genders.
Ooh, yeah.
This is your job. And I think this is such a fascinating thing to talk about, Lou. When we were prepping this, I was like, how candid do you want to be? How much can I ask you, put you on the spot about your own experience? How much do you want to talk about trans activism and what it means and how it stands with fashion? And you were like, this is what I'm doing. This is my work.
Yeah. Like I said, I think it's so important to talk about these things. I can't shut up about these topics too. So I'm like, go off, you know, ask literally anything. And there's this quote that I read in the process of researching my master's thesis, which was all about queer and trans kind of like community of fashion. And it said, my experience, our experience could be your experience, referencing the power of telling these queer stories. This fact that it's actually being a little bit personal about it actually builds empathy in a way that you maybe can't when you just have facts or numbers.
I want to stick on language and definitions and words and sort of take it right back at the conference. You hosted a panel on diversity and inclusion, equity and belonging, DIEB. And I feel like there's always a new acronym or an extension of the acronym, and not everybody's going to be familiar with this one. We all know diversity and inclusion, but the addition of these two words is really important. And I wanted to unpack one a bit, but before we do it, I'm going to just, I found this funny because it's quite corporate. Mm-hmm. But these acronyms are used as a framing in order for HR to step up in big companies, as they should do. But I got this from the UK government website. It's quite a naff, right? Diversity is being invited to the party. Inclusion is being asked to dance. Belonging is dancing like no one's watching.
Oh my God.
Okay, I know. So, terrible, terrible. But the definitions are quite useful. Diversity, they say, encompasses all the ways in which people can differ from one another, whether that be gender, race, disability, religion, sexual orientation, and or any other factors. Inclusion, meaning the voices and perspectives of all individuals will be heard and accepted. So, Lou, talk us through the importance of the addition of that word equity.
Oof. Equity acknowledges the fact that we are all coming from different levels of power in society and that we need different solutions based on our different experiences. But, you know, like, equity is kind of like, I see this almost gradation between diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. Diversity is having this kind of like very multiversal approach to identity, having everybody represented. Equity is then the acknowledgement that there is this difference in needs, this balancing out that needs to happen in order to give everybody a truly even playing field. Inclusion is then the strategies and the tools that you implement to make that balanced. But then we get to belonging, our like new little sibling in the acronym. And yeah, this panel that I led at the 2020-30 summit was kind of my baby. And I really wanted to tackle this word because it baffles me. It's so nebulous. It's so hard to really describe, like, how do you implement belonging at your company? You know, when you take this corporate approach, which I do as one of my, like, many, many different odd jobs that I kind of patchwork together, this corporate approach to DEIB. But I, like, really have kind of latched on to this image of DE and I is the chair at the table. The B, belonging, is the seat at the table. It's beyond participation, it's this feeling of home, this feeling of ownership. And like, how do you create policies around feeling like that? It's so deep and so powerful. And I really think that it's kind of like the flower that blossoms from all the rest of the systemic change that we can do.
She gave that to the UK government, mate.
They can hire me.
When we look outside of the corporate HR sphere and policies, which is its own thing, to fashion more broadly, the idea of who belongs and what that feeling of belonging might mean is obviously so different for different people. On your panel, which was brilliant, by the way, I really enjoyed it. Tell us who was on the panel in terms of speakers.
It had three local German heroes. We had Beatrice Angotula, who's the founder of Fashion Africa Now, who takes this really incredible education-focused approach to Afro-diasporic fashion. She was talking about belonging from this Black German perspective. We had Mick Morris-Mennert, who's a German Berlin-based actor and also a community manager for Auf Augenhöhe, who does fashion for people of short stature. And it's kind of this whole like adaptive fashion movement, also fashion for disabled bodies, for differently abled bodies, a really, really radical approach to body inclusivity in fashion. And he did such a lovely job of kind of explaining his own experience of walking into stores and not finding things for his body, you know?
Mick really sort of grabbed at my heartstrings because he said, I never feel like I belong in fashion because essentially I go and I try and buy clothes and can never buy adult clothing that fits me. So I always have to compromise. I always have to take it to a tailor and have it altered. But that's always some kind of compromise, not made for him. Mick's experience is of being excluded because of his physicality.
Mm.
And now he's changing it with this being part of this label that someone else founded that's about making clothes specifically for people of short stature, little people.
Yeah.
We're allowed to say little people because I really stumbled over that and wondered if the language had moved on and that might be offensive. But actually, this brand, Auf Augenhöhe, they use as the tagline in their Instagram, fashion for little people. So they're reclaiming that. So this stuff is complex, right? You don't want to offend. So you've got to find out how do they want to speak about themselves.
It is complex. I also did ask Mick directly because vocabulary is so important. Letting people self-identify, self-label is so important. And Mick actually prefers people of short stature. This is just one of those situations where we're going to screw up the language and we're all learning and it's always changing.
Yeah, but also it's different for different people who have different opinions.
Absolutely.
So there isn't a right way necessarily, but everyone's going to have a different feeling about this, right? So it's so tender.
This is also the one thing that I want to really acknowledge is the fact that you can't have just like a spokesperson for an entire community. Every community has so many diverse opinions of language and everything. You just have to ask each individual on their own, you know? And it is important to get these different perspectives while also acknowledging that it's not like Mick was just up there speaking on behalf of all people of short stature all over the world.
What's your advice on that? That feeling of fear around misstepping on the language. Oh. As a trans person, I'm presuming that you often deal with misgendering and that people stumble over using the right language. And yet, I'm talking about people who want to make you feel a sense of belonging and want not to cause offense, but actually just ignorant or don't know or scared. What's your advice?
First of all, I just want to say it's okay that it's hard. I also screw up language. I misgender people. It's difficult. It's an enormous learning curve and learning process. And it's really hard to actually be bold when we live in a cancel culture still. We live in a culture of punishment for transgressing. I would love to see that
transgressing,
change.
Transgressing, see what you did there?
Yeah, transgressing, transdressing.
Yeah, I because really, people are scared they're going to be told.
People are scared. And we still, again, we live in a culture where there's a lot of punishment for that. So I only have control over my own response. Is it exhausting to be misgendered? Yes. Does it cut a little bit when it comes from the same people I've talked to about it 30, 50 times? Yeah. But at the same time, when people feel scared to try, they're not going to. They're never going to learn. If you're somebody who has the energy to hold patience, it's in all of our best interests to do so, as long as there's respect behind it. I do not have patience for disrespect.
It comes back to that word that we used at the start, intention.
Yeah, exactly. What is it, something about the road to hell being paved paved with good intentions. Good intentions. It's slippery. Good intentions are good. Hard work is what needs to back it up.
Thank you. Actually, yes.
Yeah.
100%. Also, in this conversation about belonging, you had this fantastic activist, Anbid Zaman. You asked them, what are your preferred pronouns? And they said, he, she, they. I'm fine with all of it. I found that really interesting.
And do you remember the line that they said after that, which is, as long as it's respectful? And I was so thrilled that Anbid was able to join us for that as well. They do so much work in and around legislation around LGBTQIA plus activism in Germany. I just say queer. Not everybody agrees with that, but it's all queer to me, you know? Mm-hmm. And they also were able to give this really interesting perspective on inclusion and belonging in fashion through the perspective of the queer body, which not everybody realizes, but is another form of adaptive fashion, actually. Transitioning bodies have completely different needs from sizing, from fit, from pattern making than cisgendered bodies do. It's not only about finding what feels right aesthetically, but when you have a transitioning body, you start to shapeshift a little. It's really alchemical. It's really wild. But there's for example, a fantastic brand called Both And Apparel who does pattern cutting specifically for trans masculine bodies. The founder did extensive research with different members of the trans masculine community, trans non-binary community, actually remeasuring bodies to create entirely new pattern blocks to fit this one demographic that's been completely excluded from fashion.
If you are listening to this, someone who works in design or has studied fashion design, this is going to blow your mind because we know that pattern making and blocks and sizing is locked in not only gendered binary traps, but also dates from like the 20s. I mean, I always remember writing about this for a Vogue story a long time ago and finding out when they first measured those supposedly universal body shapes of a woman. Come on. Like, it's actually crazy. And yet, I mean, never mind gender. Let's just talk about all shapes and sizes, all ages, everything. It's completely demented. And yet, most brands are still using this very simplified, completely inaccurate measurement system to create blocks for cutting clothes. It's crazy.
Oh my gosh, it's insane. And especially like,
so far to go.
When you look at buying power of like, again, this is where my weird like corporate half of my brain comes into all of this, occupying that world, but just looking at like who is being left out and why brands, if you're going to be trying to sell fashion, you're missing an enormous part of the population.
We're still having this conversation about supposedly so-called plus-sized women. So, I mean, there's a heck of a long way to go for a wider net to be cast around inclusivity. Something that Mick said on your panel was that when they'd first talked about this brand that catered for people of short stature, the investors or, I don't know, people they were pitching it to were saying, but, oh, come on, the market is so small. And then he was saying, but we're here. And obviously, maybe if you're looking in one neighborhood, it's so small. But if you look at the world, these are people with needs. And these people with needs have a right to clothes that make them feel included and the dignity of that. But hang on, I think I've got a question. There is still a commercial question around, is the market big enough to sustain a brand like that?
You know, actually, this is also kind of where I get off. And this is why, in large part, I feel pretty let down by the fashion industry because it shouldn't be about that. Honestly, Claire, I don't really give a damn if there's a market for it or not.
If you can make 50,000 units and waste them.
If it's a profitable market, exactly. And this is where the industry actually – it's not just that the industry needs to change. It's that the industry needs to deindustrialize. If we were moving towards systems where garments could be made on demand, where we had a fashion practice, kind of like a wardrobe approach of buying less so we can spend more on it so that it fits us better and lasts longer. I'm not trying to just like shoehorn in a totally new concept here, but like actually what underpins all of this is the need to slow down, to work with intention. the industry itself, while it's an industry, is not going to meet these needs. It can't. It can't do it under capitalism. It's going to not support itself financially. This is where we see designers also like struggling. Designers trying to address these niche populations. It's a slog. And it's an uphill battle that I fear like a lot of them aren't going to win because it's not growth driven.
Mm. Actually, I think that's quite a nice segue into what we've seen at Berlin Fashion Week this week and presumably all the time. I mean, I've only just been back here for the first time in years. But there was this real feeling with so many of the shows that they were community driven, that they were designers who were speaking to almost like they're dressing their friends. And all the friends were there on the front row and in the back and cheering on, wearing their gear, instead of this feeling of a very commercial luxury maybe you'd get in Paris or Milan, all about setting a global trend on Instagram and making a load of money. This was about, no, I'm dressing my friends. And some of my friends in some cases happen to be incredible trans activists and models. I'm dressing the people I go clubbing with. I've got an audience and they're all here. Look at them. It felt very energetic.
It's so much more exciting, to me at least, that there is such a wide net of participation here. I also, okay, is it okay if I throw one more vocab piece at you? One other, I think, really important term that comes into play with my approach to fashion in general is this term communities of practice. So we talk about fashion practice, but then what happens when you do that in a group setting? I feel like I spent years really wanting a queer community of fashion practice. And I only found it about a year ago, actually. And so Berlin's got incredible local designers, very DIY, very punk still. But I'm like, what happens when you peer even deeper under that rug in this city? And I had the pleasure of co-facilitating this past year a queer needlework circle.
I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah. It's we meet weekly. Okay, like fashion industry needs to do all these things better. But what happens when we take fashion into this context where we're just sitting around on a Wednesday evening teaching each other how to crochet? Like, it sounds awfully twee. And
that's,
I'm okay rad. With that.
I love it. You know, Fashion Revolution have this thing called Stitch and Bitch, which is activism circles.
I love a good Stitch and Bitch. That's also very much what this is. But there's something about it, doing it specifically with other queer people, that is like even more magical when we're all talking about finding the sense of rightness in our own bodies. You know, when you have a body, whether you're gay or you're trans or you're non-binary, a body that is still really not represented in mainstream media, especially in mainstream fashion media, to get together in these spaces and say like, oh my gosh, look at these pants that I made and they fit me like this and this is why I made them. You know, we put together a fashion show this fall, all themed around power suits. This idea that the power suit is the clothing that you wear to make you feel your most empowered, your most embodied. And for me, this is the real power of fashion. This is the real power of fashion and communication, communicating through dress. You asked about these pants and what they say. One of the things that the pants talks about is this kind of positive feedback loop between embodiment and empowerment. Embodiment meaning, you know, dress that makes you feel at home in your skin. When you're trans, you don't take that feeling for granted. There's this term gender euphoria, which is this feeling of like exuberance, being in your gender. I believe it actually has to be preceded by gender dysphoria. When you come from a trans experience, you have this moment of feeling like your body is not your body. It's terrifying. It didn't hit me personally until I was 29, 30 years old. It was really, really weird.
You sent me an essay, Lou.
Yeah.
That you'd written for an indie magazine. It's called Soft.
Soft Ice.
Soft Ice.
Yeah, do you know what it means?
No.
It means like soft serve ice cream.
Oh.
Yeah,
well,
isn't that cute?
I was going to say that, but I was like, surely not. There's some German take on it. Except it is ice, E-I-S.
E-I.
Soft ice.
Yeah, soft ice.
It's titled Trans Unraveling Ritual. And I've got to say, I just want to tell the world this. I invited you on the podcast because I knew you had such a beautiful way of unpacking complicated ideas in a really relatable and inviting empathetic way. But God, you're a good writer. I look forward to your memoirs.
Oh my gosh, Claire, it really...
It's brilliant, this essay. Anyway, you write about living with generalized anxiety disorder for years and this persistent feeling of, and I quote, something's wrong, but not by quite being able to pin that down. And you say, this paranoia clarified and peaked during my master's thesis research when I was reading queer theory for the first time. I pieced it together. Holy shit, am I trans? The question had never crossed my mind because I'd always been equally detached from manhood and womanhood, riding the millennial non-binary culture wave. I hope you don't mind me reading out your words, Lou, but I just think that's a very... There's two things in there that I would love for you to talk to us about. Mm. One is personal, if you don't mind me asking, your story. But before we do that, the millennial non-binary culture wave.
Haha. It's a thing. Yeah, I mean...
Is it a thing? Is it a made-up thing? What is happening?
What is happening is I have had the good fortune to be born into a generation where we can actually talk about this feeling of not being beholden to a gender binary. The gender binary is man and woman. The gender binary is not male or female. I also want to just make this explicitly clear that gender is aesthetic and behavior and identity. It doesn't have a ton to do with your physical body, but that's also part of it. It's complicated like that. It's part of it and it's not. When I talk about gender, I talk specifically about this feeling of being inside your body, not about what your body actually is shaped like, not about your genitalia or anything like this. I feel so lucky to be born in a time where there's vocabulary to be between and also outside of the male, female, man, woman binary. I use the term non-binary because it's culturally accepted in my generation and in Gen Z. I am not Gen Z. I am very much a millennial.
How old are you?
How old am I? 32. Yeah.
You look 21. Well done.
Stop.
What skincare are you using?
trans keeps you young. It's called testosterone. This little dirt stash. Anyhow, I prefer the term anti-binary. I'm very much a gender anarchist. Yeah, I don't know. I'm like, male and female are very Western colonial concepts.
I will refer listeners, and we'll put a link in the introductory notes to an episode that we did in our past, the Mac Series 5, where Aditi Mayer interviewed Alok Ved Menon.
Yes.
About the cultural history of the gender binary. It's basically a textbook. You need to listen to it. It's really good.
And everyone needs to follow Alok Ved Menon on Instagram. They are honestly pulling beyond their fair share of weight in this like pop cultural education around gender. It is so contemporary. They're such a brilliant writer.
But just coming back on this non-binary culture wave of Gen Z or whatever, millennial.
Both.
What has freed up this conversation? And what would you say, and I know this is a kind of a horrible question, but I'd love you to speak on it if you feel comfortable, to all those kind of old people who are like, I don't get it. I can't understand it. Why are my kids suddenly questioning this stuff? It never made any sense to us because we never had that language for it.
I think that it comes back to this, my story, our story could be your story thing. We live, Claire, I think it's actually directly thanks to the internet. And as a self-proclaimed Luddite, this is one of the few things I thank digital technology for, is our ability to share these stories across time and space. When you're queer, you're not born into that legacy through your bloodline. You have to find it. You start to feel these things. You start to feel this inner displacement, this inner lack of things quite connecting. When you're able to go on a forum and, you know, the year is 2002 and you're able to just for the first time in contemporary Western history talk to other people who are like, no, I feel this too. This is how this all, I think, was able to snowball so quickly.
It makes me cry. I'm about to cry because I'm an emotional, I cry all the time. But just think about if you happen to be a listener who's got some transphobia or is convinced that Gen Z is making this up. And I know that sounds extremely controversial, but you only have to look at a tabloid newspaper to see that people feel like this. The reason why I'm moved to tears listening to you speak, though, is because imagine feeling that no one's like you and then finally realizing that there's this whole world of people just like you. All this is about that all, you can't make it reductive, but that word belonging.
Yeah.
Why would you ever not want people to feel a sense of belonging?
Absolutely. And, you know, when it comes to this ever-evolving, like, oh, God, it's so hard to keep up approach to identity and to gender, like, be excited about this yes-and approach. Like, you know, people are talking more openly about being transgender. And then when we start to evolve all these non-binary post-gender identities, even getting into, I don't know, transhumanism, for example, where people want to merge with technology. It's like, well, if I feel a certain kind of way and somebody else does too, well, what else? What else do we feel that we're not talking about yet?
This is your lived experience. So it is, and the only reason that I feel comfortable asking you these questions is because we prepared this before and I said, how comfortable are you? How far can I go? But how does it make, well, my question is, why do you think people are so scared of this? Why do you think some people are so scared of this? And the issue around trans rights and identification and culture has been kind of pushed into the culture wars.
Fear is taught. Fear of otherness is taught, specifically. And when I say, you know, oh, we're in this whole culture wave of non-binary, blah, blah, this is actually not new. We've had more than two genders in cultures across the world for millennia. We have two spirit identities and also a plethora of other gender identities in Indigenous American cultures. You have
South Asian cultures.
South Asian cultures, subcontinental Indian cultures, literally everywhere around the world in pre-colonial cultures. There were more than two genders. And it manifested differently everywhere. You know, this is, you could do an entire podcast on just this history. And so actually, Claire, when you ask why people are scared, it is directly tied to colonial legacy.
Power.
It's tied to power and yeah, it's tied to subjugation.
Yeah, except that I agree with you systemically and yes, certainly in terms of the politicization of this like woke fear and toxic culture war rubbish that comes from right-wing politicians. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. What about the parent who sees themselves as just a bit ordinary and isn't really tapped into this big discussion around systems?
Mm. I think, all right, if we is don't want to get into the history. No, but
is it about worrying that your kid isn't going to fit in or worrying that your kid's going to be bullied? Is it that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if parents really love their kids, though, they'll trust them when they say, I'm feeling pain. I'm feeling the specific kind of pain, and it's worse than the pain of being bullied. If you love your kids, let them talk to you. Don't shut down the lines of communication. One reason, Claire, that I have so much energy to talk about this, I feel like actually a unicorn in this world that I don't have family trauma around my queerness. I have the two most embracing parents that I could possibly imagine. Literally from when I, way back in the day, came out as bisexual at 18 to my mom to, you know, coming out within the past 2 years as like, I'm actually really trans non-binary. I am way more out there than I ever knew before this. For them to just continually be like, cool, tell us more. What do we do to support you? They're getting on board with the language. I have two queer siblings, another one who is trans non-binary. Yeah, a little shout out to Sawyer and Ivy. But we're a family that has boldly kind of moved through all of this together. I am able to sit here and talk to you today without tearing up, without shutting
because
down.
Of that. Yeah.
Because I don't know disownment. Like, I have my chosen family of other queer people. I also have my blood family of queer people and allies and I could ask for no greater gift in this world.
And you wish for that for others.
And
by talking about this stuff, maybe we can help that happen a little bit.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Okay, before we get off the real hard questions, I did just want to ask if you would be willing to read a little bit out from your essay that I just mentioned. Mm. Would you?
Yeah, I would love to.
What would you choose? I'll let you choose which bit.
Just the bit that kind of names the hard part and also the bravery that gets us up in the morning when we're moving through it. Yeah, so I wrote, we, trans non-binary people, we didn't grow up with TV that shows what folks like us wear, what we eat, where we live, who we love, how we fuck, how we age. Aside from the queer shelf in the ivory tower, whose restricted access renders it luxury, we have few role models and fewer rule books. We vibrate in a rhizome of stories and encounters, pulled by some collective intuition that home might be a liquid body, that a name could change again before tomorrow. We live in liminality to prove to each other that it can actually work. We collectively dream up folklore that prophesies a future of tangled unmaking and remaking. We build utopias in our bodies, neighborhoods, and online forums where the indefinite versions of ourselves can coexist. Unraveling is both a sport and a prayer, I've learned.
Thank you, beautiful. I want to end on why you think it's so important for fashion to engage with this topic. When we were chatting before, I was saying, isn't fashion already just a really welcoming place? I was saying that I've been in this hotel and I went down for breakfast and it was just full of middle-aged white men. And because we were going to have a conversation about gender, really struck me. I was like, wow, everyone's the same. And everyone is like a middle-aged white businessman. Fashion's not like that. Fashion to me has always seemed to be this colourful, inclusive, welcoming place where, I was saying to you before, it's if you take the commercial out of it, fashion school and indie labels, they're where people come to find themselves and belong and find other people like them. Is it not like that?
It's not like that. And I do see that changing. I think especially with gender, it's changing faster.
But why do you say it's not like that though? Because you said that to me before. You're like, no, I don't agree.
Because it still privileges conventionally pretty people. It still privileges predominantly white people. It privileges wealthy people who can afford to go to fashion school, who can afford to take the unpaid internship as they're moving into the industry. It still privileges this very narrow realm. And maybe there's, you know, gender expansion for these people. Maybe they're finding this liberation. But this is why I think that fashion practice is what's really for everyone. I rarely buy new clothes. I thrift. I'm a big thrifter. I'm a big upcycler. And there's this patching together of little bits and pieces. It's kind of like collaging identity at this certain point, which is why practice is more interesting to me than fashion industry. It's not about what is this genius creative masterminds making in their atelier. It's about what is your own creative approach when you're getting up in the morning and you're saying, how do I want to feel today? I think it's even interesting when it's the businessman who's like, oh my God, is it the blue plaid shirt or is it the gray shirt with no plaid and does the tie look right? Like, even that fascinates me. We're little magpies, right? Like, we adorn whether we think about it or not. I think my call for everyone, especially if you are not a trans, non-binary, gender anarchist like I am, think about those choices. Dare yourself with those choices. And it, you know, you don't have to dissolve your own gender in order to be intentional about your gender. You can cultivate a greater sense of embodiment when you notice what your body feels like in the clothes that you put on your body. And if you do just a little bit of research, you can also channel that same intentionality to shopping towards garments that harm the planet less, whether it's buying secondhand or buying from more ethical brands, buying brands that are attempting to be more sustainable.
I love that you brought it back to sustainability.
Yeah, we have to do the PSA. It really, listen, it's all about first skin, second skin, first body, second body. First skin is what's, you know, your birthday suit. Second skin, the clothes you put on it. First body, it's your body. Second body is Earth.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. You can find the show notes for each episode and read our magazine over on our website, www.thewardrobecrisis.com. And that's where you can also sign up for our free sustainable fashion newsletters. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I'd love you to help us spread the word. Tell a friend, share on social media, or leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps new listeners find us on the app. You can get in touch with us on social media. The show is on Instagram, at The Wardrobe Crisis, and I'm on there too. And on Twitter, I'm at Mrs. Press.
Because I love you, because I love you, because I love you, because I love you.